I have to admit, when I binge watched Making a Murderer, I did not fast forward through the beginning.
No, the theme song sets you up for the rest of the show. It's perfect.
But
it's
I watched 10 in a row and still didn't fast forward because you need to see the vision they have of Manitowoc, Wisconsin. It is perfect. Mm-hmm. Now, you are not caught up, are you?
I'm on episode 3. I got a little ways to go.
Kevin, you're finished?
Oh, yeah. All right. Burned through it.
I just want to say this now for listeners who... I don't want to ruin things. I don't want to spoil things for you. But if you haven't seen the whole thing, then maybe you don't want to listen to this interview.
All right. So take a little time off.
Or we'll maybe you do. Yeah. Like I knew information about this show before I started binge watching it one Friday night into Saturday morning. I will, in a nutshell, and you're up to episode 3. Without giving things away, there's this guy, Stephen Avery, who is from a family of what appears to be ne'er-do-wells in comparison to the other members of the community.
Farm community, but they have like an auto junkyard. They're not farmers like everybody else, so they're kind of outcasts in this town.
And Stephen Avery has been in some kind... He's not a great guy. He's had some issues.
Right.
The first episode, I believe, even has him... Was that when it all started, the first episode where he was arrested for attacking and raping a woman on the beach?
Did a lot of jail time for a crime he did not commit.
18 years.
18 years. And I don't know how much more we want to say at this point, but it.
Well, I have to say a little more.
All right.
I have to say a little more. So, again, spoiler alert, because on the line with us is John Cameron. He's an FBI cold case worker. You've been featured on America's Most Wanted, Dateline NBC. I was on your website. And the big question, and every time we talk about Making a Murderer, there was another crime after being in prison for 18 years. Stephen Avery was convicted of another crime, this involving a murder of an Auto Trader photographer. And if you watch the court proceedings, you have questions as a viewer going, well, what about this person? What about that person? There are many times you don't think it's Stephen Avery, but no one cares. It's Stephen Avery, murder, whatever. John Cameron has a different theory and a question people have been asked. If it wasn't Stephen Avery, then who was it? John, welcome to the show. And you have an idea of who it may be that actually killed. And I got to get her name because I feel terrible I don't bring up her name. Teresa.
Well, thanks for having me on, Bill and Wendy. Her name was Teresa Hallback.
Right.
That was the victim's name.
And I feel really heartbroken for her family that this case is out there. I really do. I mean, bottom line is someone's dead. This young girl is dead. So I just wanted to get that out.
The beginning of this for me really started with the Avery case just in the last few weeks. But I was involved in a serial killer investigation the last 6 years. And this serial killer I investigated actually started his killings and setups in Chicago in 1946. And he ended them in Chicago in 2009. And in between that 63 years of killing, he set people up all over the country. So I'd never heard of Steve Avery or Teresa Hallback or anything like this until the Netflix documentary came out. And it just fell right into place with the investigation I've been doing the last 6 years.
John, how could a guy go 63 years killing people and not get caught? That seems impossible to me.
Yeah, it seemed impossible to everybody, you know, and I didn't begin this thing trying to solve all these major cases that this man did. I really started my investigation in 2010, just trying to get him to confess to a double lover's lane murder he did here in Montana in 1956. That's where I'm from, and that's where I was a cop. But his ruse was basically to travel the country with a wife and children and groom his way into his victims through religious retreats or through actually policemen, lawyers, he knew them all, and then kill someone close to him and set somebody up.
And that's it, framing someone else. That was part of what seems to be his thrill was killing someone, but then to also watch someone go down for his crime.
That's exactly what he enjoyed. He called it crimes of recognition. You know, he killed from age 12 in 1945 until age 76 in 2009. And every one of his crimes of recognition were actually murders of recognition. And what he would do is he would pick his victims deliberately, sometimes years in advance, if not decades in advance, to kill them or kill someone close to them and set someone up close to them. And then he would love to stand in front of the investigation under assumed identity and be the helper. And nobody knew the killer was there. And constantly send cryptic letters and messages to the press, to the police, to the victim's family, and taunt them with his identity. So he really enjoyed the setup, because what he could do now that he's dead, he died in 2011, is he can continue to kill in his afterlife with the people he set up that are on death row.
All right. Now, there's an addendum to this story. Was there some cryptic message that you got wind of even today?
Yeah, there was. You know, I was on the radio a couple weeks ago, and I predicted that if Edwards was involved in the Teresa Halbach case, there would have been a letter sent after Steve Avery was arrested and before they arrested the second 16-year-old, Brendan Dassey.
His
nephew.
That's what
he did in all of his cases. He would send cryptic letters that actually contained the details of how he did the killing. And it would just be a big taunt to the authorities, is the letter writer is the real killer. The letter writer is the real killer. And within the letter, there's always his identity. And in the Avery case, there's a cryptic letter that is spoke about for 18 pages in the trial transcripts. And the judge refused to bring it in and refused to let the jury see it. I have not seen it yet, but I'm working on trying to get it. But that's exactly what Edwards did throughout his life, was write those cryptic letters that actually were him. It was him.
We have John Cameron on the line with us, retired police detective from Great Falls, Montana. If you go to your website's coldcasecameron.com.
That's right.
Bill, you haven't gotten to episode 6 yet of mm-hmm. Making a Murderer, but this is something that surprised me when I was reading the article about you, John. This guy who, did we name his name? Edward Wayne Edwards. This is who you're referring
to. Yeah, that's his name.
I don't think we ever got that out. The serial killer you've never heard of. But now, is there any truth to the fact that Edward Wayne Edwards was in the Manitowoc area about the time Teresa Halbach was murdered and subsequently was seen in the courtroom in episode 6?
Yeah, my investigation of Ed Edwards that I actually published in 2014 showed that what he liked to do is not only kill, set someone up, but then he would attend the funerals or attend the court hearings or he would attend public gatherings to get himself photographed at the scene. And in episode 6 on Netflix of Making a Murderer, at 21 minutes and 33 seconds, there's a shot of a man in a blue sweater standing at the courthouse door behind the prosecutor. And it lasts about 6 seconds. And it looks like Edward Edwards. It has all the height, the weight, the age, the look, and the stance of what he liked to do when he was standing at his scene. And in the stance, he's basically giving you the bird with his left hand pointing down, and he's staring directly into the camera. And it just lasts 5 seconds, and that's all he would have needed, is to get involved in his own murder investigation and be standing in front of everybody, because that's what he did his whole life.
It's the final, you know, not only killing someone, but setting someone else up to take the fall, and then the final, like, F you at
right.
the end when he shows up at these funerals. And now, how do we find out? I mean, John Cameron again on the line with us, and episode 6, what is it, 21 minutes in, 21 what?
21 minutes, 33 seconds into episode 6.
We looked at it. Kevin and I were watching it, and I am just intrigued by this whole Netflix series. And it does look like him. You can't be 100% sure, because the photos then we saw of him older than that, it was difficult to tell. But now, who can you speak to? Who can anybody speak to find out who that person was in the courtroom?
Well, I actually
or in the hallway.
I traveled to Wisconsin last week to see if the Manitowoc County Sheriff would help me identify that man. But they wouldn't actually even talk to me.
Why?
So I did visit with the Averys. That's the way this has always been. You know, Edwards set people up all over the country. And there's at least 10 people right now sitting in prison on his murders. Some are on death row. And when the police find out that they got the wrong guy, they hunker down. And that's what Making a Murderer, when people watch it, will see. But that really documentary is what happened in all of Ed Edwards' setups. Because the evidence was false. The police followed the false trail. and suddenly it was wrong. And they just hunker down and they don't admit because of liability.
But John, you yourself are a retired police detective. Was there ever a directive from anyone higher than you? Did you ever witness that firsthand? Did you see or hear that happen?
My entire investigation in the last 6 years was exactly how it played out on that documentary. When I tried to approach police departments, prosecutors, attorneys, with the information I had on Ed Edwards, and he always put it out there. It was always in the cryptic letters and his appearances. They didn't want to hear it because they'd already convicted somebody. And I found over 36 wrongful convictions, and one man was executed in 1957 on one of Ed's murders. So they don't want to admit liability, and the FBI never did an investigation of serial killer Edward and Edward Wayne Edwards when he was finally caught in 2010.
They didn't.
No, he was an informant since 1951 for FBI, law enforcement everywhere. He knew him everywhere. And basically, he would get caught for burglary, robbery, and then he'd go into prison and he'd start ratting on people and ratting on his own murders to set up the people that he'd already planned the murder to go to. And he'd get out early and do it again and do it again and do it again. And he was always standing in front of us.
We have we're talking to John Cameron, retired police detective. We're talking about Edward Wayne Edwards, the book that you have. It's Me, Edward Wayne Edwards, the serial killer you never heard of. You can go to his website, coldcasecameron.com. I hate to do these spoilers. Somebody just texted us and said, pretty stupid to tell a bunch of listeners not to listen to your show, but I don't want to spoil some of this. And this Making a Murderer, it just really sucked me into it. A tiny spoiler alert, there was some evidence saying that another police district was calling Manitowoc saying, we have someone who's confessing to this murder, and they said, nope, case solved. It makes total sense to me that they would not want to revisit a mistake they made. Conversely, though, John, you have Stephen Avery, who was busted once falsely. Is lightning going to strike twice? Could he be convicted again falsely? It's like you have two camps here.
Yeah, it's really horrible what happened to Stephen, because he spent 18 years in prison for an assault he didn't do.
And never gave up. I mean, never gave up. They said, if you confess, if you do anything, you can be up for parole, otherwise forget it. He's like, why would I confess to something I didn't do?
Yeah.
What's even worse is, in some of Edwards' cases, guys actually went into court and pled guilty to the murder so they wouldn't be executed. And their description to me every time why they did that was, how can I prove my innocence if I'm dead? And that's this mindset of people that are wrongfully convicted that are offered a plea deal. Well, we're going to kill you, or we're going to give you life. What are you going to accept? And their mindset is, I'll take life because I got to prove my innocence.
John, can I ask you, well, let's do this. Are you okay on time? We want to take a quick break. Are you all right to answer more questions?
Yeah, I can stay as long as you need.
All right, John Cameron is our guest. If you want to know more about
this. Isn't this so great? I'm sorry. I'm so sorry Teresa Halbach got killed.
Yeah,
I'm sorry an innocent man was in jail for 18 years, but this is just fascinating.
It's chilling. I don't know how this happens. All right, we'll discuss this more. If you want to jump in, 312-981-7200. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN.
Making a Murderer, it's a Netflix original series. We have phone calls into the two women who took 10 years of their life making this, which a lot of people are saying it's a one-sided view. A lot of the prosecution issues have been left out. It's just fascinating to watch. We're trying to get a hold of the filmmakers to talk to them. And we have John Cameron on the line with us right now, retired police detective from Great Falls, Montana. You've worked on FBI serial killer task forces, and you've written a book, It's Me, Edward Wayne Edwards, the serial killer you never heard of. Visit his website at coldcasecameron.com. All right, John, we are talking about the Stephen Avery case, and we have a question from one of our listeners. And this is Jenny on the line with us. Jenny, John Cameron.
Hi, Wendy. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Jenny.
Hi, John. I am just as intrigued as Wendy is with this. I've watched the series twice now, trying to pick up the second time seeing if there's things I can pick up I missed in the first.
I know, I'm going to watch it again,
series.
Too.
Yeah, you can't help it. But I wanted to know, do you think that then Manitowoc County framed him, Steve, because of his past and how he was, you know, when he was younger, and they made it sound like he was in trouble a lot? Do you think that they tried to frame him?
No, but the killer himself actually framed not only Steve, but also was framing the police, because the police were all over the press also just before the murder, because they were being deposed. They had lied in his previous conviction, and they were going to pay $36 million. And so how Edwards would work is he would pick his victims that are in the press a lot. Well, in the Avery case, you know, the victim, Steve, was all over the press. You had the police all over the press. And it was as simple as grooming his way into the police like he had done his whole life. He was always the helper, showing up on his scenes to find the victim when he, in fact, had done it. And so the whole intention was to set up the police also. So this, the police planting the blood and the police doing all this stuff, that didn't happen. But the serial killer was inside and did it all to lead that way. And that's what it looks like.
Well, so what do you mean he was inside? And he so the
well,
police,
he was working with, he was an informant, correct?
Right. Edwards would groom his way into the searches for his own victims. He was a civil patrol expert. He went around the country teaching a first aid and civil patrol how he could help find bodies. And so the day, you know, the hours before they found Teresa's car, that was all done by volunteers at a church. And that's where Edwards always groomed his way into, was the church. And he would be the helper. Nobody would even think anything of it. He was 72 years old. He'd just be that nice old man that's given us some good advice.
There. And do you think also then with the nephew as well? Because I know, unfortunately, you know, they make him out to be somebody who's a little slow and things, and it seemed like right away he said no, he had nothing to do with it. Then he said he did, and he talked about different things. And
that is a heartbreaking moment where some of his testimony, he talks about. They said, well, how did you come up with this? And he mentions a book that he read.
Yes.
And a friend of mine had read the book, and that scene is pretty much in there as he described. Jenny, we have to let you go, but you can continue listening. How about that, John?
Well, let me tell you, you know, when Steve got arrested and they didn't even know what happened, because there really was no evidence that she'd been killed in the house or in the garage. They didn't know how she'd been killed. Then suddenly, a month later, they get this cryptic letter. And it's anonymous, and it's to the sheriff. And it details that she was killed by rope, by knife, by gun, by fire, burned in a kiln. And that's what Edwards did in all of his cases. And so they took the information and went after Brendan, because that letter has to somehow steer it to Brendan, because Brendan had gone over to the house that night. And so, boom, 4 months later, they bring in Brendan. They start pummeling him with this scenario.
16 years old, obviously some developmental issues. It's heartbreaking to watch it without lawyers present. I mean, there are just some things in there that cannot be explained how that happened.
Well, even when they bring Avery in, the detective questioning him says, come on, we know you did it. Just admit to it. We know that you've had a hard life, that you spent time in jail for a crime you didn't commit. We feel bad about that. But you obviously did this. I mean, they're leading him like crazy.
But he doesn't break.
He doesn't break.
A 16-year-old who is really... he is challenged, definitely.
Yeah.
I would break down.
Yeah.
I would say I did it just to stop the pressure.
Yeah. John, can I ask you, with Edward Wayne Edwards, you said that his modus operandi was to travel around the country. He would move from place to place. And I think you said with a wife and possibly even family, huh? Is that possible?
Yeah, he actually had, you know, he was married 43 years when he finally got caught in 2009.
Yes, so how does she not know that that was going on? Is it possible to live with somebody for that long and not know they had a hobby like that?
Well, you know, he was an evil man. He had stabbed his wife. He wouldn't let her go to the hospital. He repaired her. He controlled her. She was like the Stockholm Syndrome, basically, a kidnap victim for 43 years. If he put her up in a campground with the kids, they had a different name, and she didn't talk about it because he'd just kill her. And he had two previous wives and previous children back in the 50s when he was here in Montana and he killed. And that's exactly how he did it. He just portrayed himself as this great guy, family man, and used that as an alibi. But those poor people, all of his family members, had nothing to do with what this guy did.
sort of similar to Holmes from Devil in the White City. There's a lot of parallels. Are you seeing that too?
You know, there are so many parallels to Ed Edwards, because what he would do is base his murders and his setups on the seven deadly sins. He would go after people that might be cheating on their wives, or maybe have some burglary convictions, or who are going to church claiming they're really holy and then they're not. It was all based on the occult from the very beginning, because he was so destroyed in a Catholic orphanage by age 5 and 6 that he just came out a sadomasochist by the age of 12, creating crimes of recognition and setting people up.
You need to, you I'm sure you already know this, but you need to sell this to Hollywood. This needs to be a movie.
You know what's funny about Ed Edwards? Not funny, but all of his murders are already turned into movies, because he created myths. He created mysteria and things that didn't seem plausible, and they were all made into movies, and everybody wondered, who did it? Who is he? That was really part of his MO, too, was to be that mystical guy.
Like that movie Seven, really, does that have anything to do? Because as soon as you said it, that's the first movie I thought of.
That's exactly what he did. He would kill for the seven deadly sins.
And how many films or television shows have we seen where whoever's organizing the search party to go through the forest and try to find the body, that's the guy who did it? We see that 1,000 times.
Well, that's what's making a murderer, too. There are people that were operating a search party for poor Teresa Halbach and admitted in court that they erased some messages because they knew the password. There were two people, a former boyfriend and a roommate. Why were they not questioned?
Well, they were actually questioned extensively about that cell phone incident, because Edwards had actually used other victims' cell phones after Halbach's murder in 3 different occasions, 2008, 2009. He would steal their cell phones. He would go into them. He would erase messages. He would send messages. Jeez. He would break into their email accounts, their Facebook pages, and direct the evidence to the guilty, the one he wants to get. So the phone thing with those guys isn't unusual, and people are trying to, you know, put them as the guys that killed Teresa Halbach.
But well, we're seeing one side of it from the filmmakers, and so I didn't know they were investigated, because what you're seeing is them, oh, okay, you erased a message, sure, go ahead, that's fine now, you know? So we are seeing a one-sided view, but John, listen, let's keep in touch, and if anything comes up with this cryptic letter that you just received, and I know they're not talking to you in Manitowoc because they don't maybe want to admit that there was someone else guilty for Stephen Avery's crime. But please keep in touch with us. And in the meantime, we will keep in touch with you by going to coldcasecameron.com. John Cameron, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on.
Absolutely. Wow. How about that?
This is some heavy, heavy stuff, man.
I think so. All right. We're going to take a quick break. Steve's got the news for you next. It's Bill and Wendy, WGN.